This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. This week, we've been grappling with the aftermath of mass shootings in Dayton and El Paso. At least 31 people were killed. Today, we want to look at what it takes for a community to heal from that type of tragedy and what, if anything, we can do to help prevent it in the future. Joining me now on the line is Congressman Richard Neal. He represents Massachusetts' 1st District and is the dean of the New England delegation. Representative Neal, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Delighted to be with you.
Congressman, later this hour, we're going to hear from mayors of some cities who have, you know, unfortunate firsthand experience with mass shootings and the process of community healing. We'd like to focus our conversation with you on policy in the wake of this weekend. What leadership do you think is needed from Washington to help America heal and move forward?
Well, I think that it's important to point out that it appears to be certainly a pathology that's associated with these events, and it seems to be isolated young men who perpetrate the horror of these crimes against innocent victims. And when you consider the backgrounds of some of these individuals, they also have an online presence. And I think trying to monitor that online presence that they have when they say or threaten to do something that is deserving of more attention from the FBI or other law enforcement agencies strikes me as being the appropriate response. When you consider this spate of shootings that we've had across the country, they also are more and more targeting what are known as soft targets. Those are places where there will not be a great deal of security. There certainly would not seem to be monitoring of their activities. And I think as part of the national debate here, it's time that we found some common ground around background checks, mental health records, registration of what happens at these gun shows. And I think that in addition to that, clearly, if somebody has a criminal history, then it strikes me as though there ought to be a reasonable response from law enforcement officials in anticipation of what they might request in terms of online military or quasi-military sales.
Representative Neal, you just mentioned background checks. Washington Post reported last night that the president's having private conversations with lawmakers from both parties where he's expressed at least openness to supporting extensive background checks. Do you believe that? And if you do, what would it take to get that through Congress?
Well, there's a piece of legislation that was passed in the House of Representatives that would do precisely that. So I think if the president is serious or he's earnest about this, then I think the opportunity is right in front of us. Ask the Senate to take the legislation as proposed, amended and passed, and put it up on the Senate floor. The majority leader is in charge of the docket as to what takes place on the Senate floor. He sets the schedule every day with virtually no input from the minority. And it strikes me that this could happen in a matter of days, given the president's recent suggestions, which, by the way, have drawn considerable pushback from the National Rifle Association.
Which makes me wonder, can it really happen, Congressman?
That's a great question. And I think that part of the challenge we have here is that when you look at statistical data that indicates that up to 95% of the American people think that there ought to be mental health background checks, it strikes me as though that's not a ladder that's too tall to climb. That reasonable people ought to be able to say that before you can purchase a gun, there ought to be a waiting period. There ought to be a review of criminal history. There ought to be a review as to whether or not there's been evidence of spousal abuse. And I think that in this instance here, criminality is criminality. And if an individual has been involved in a criminality with a gun, that ought to set off a red flag.
So you've talked about some of the policy options there that are, they seem to be more broadly supported across the American public. Let's talk about one that's only supported at a little bit above 50% in a polling, and that's assault weapon bans. According to lawyers for the El Paso shooter's family, the shooter's mother actually called police over concerns that he owned an AK-style rifle, but police said that there was nothing they could do because he was legally allowed to own the weapon. I know you support an assault weapon ban, and President Trump, though, said yesterday, hey, there's no political appetite for that. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's contrary to what happened when we actually passed an assault weapons ban, and I voted for it. For 10 years, the assault weapons ban was in place, and it worked. And it was allowed to lapse only because Republicans had taken control of Congress. And at the time, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, Tom DeLay, he pushed for letting it lapse. So I think that there is precedent. It was done. adjustments were made. And if you use the model of what's happened in Massachusetts, it strikes me that, again, this is a reasonable policy. I don't know anybody who's ever said that they need an AK-47 to go hunting on the weekend.
Now, you represent the 1st District, though, which includes Springfield, home of the gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson. Any gun control legislation, obviously there's some risk that it could end up negatively impacting some of your constituents who maybe work for the company. How do you manage that tension or reconcile that as we have conversations on gun control?
Well, I think that the many police organizations across the country, they use Smith & Wesson weapons. The military uses Smith & Wesson weapons. I mean, there is no argument here on my behalf that we should be taking guns away from those who use it for target practice, those that use it for hunting, those who are gun collectors. And in fact, I think that those are all reasonable parts of the argument, but we're not suggesting that. What we're suggesting is that every opportunity that has availed itself to talk about even the most minor incursion into the gun rights industry, you will hear the NRA, not necessarily these companies, but the NRA will say, oh, that's a step in the wrong direction, that this will invite more monitoring, more control of these industries. And I think that the assault weapons ban, as I noted, that was in place for 10 years, did not do that.
Okay, before we move on, there are some other things I want to ask you about. I just want to ask one more time. Something like an assault weapons ban, yes, it passed in 94, but as you say, it was gone after 2004. What would it take to get something like that passed again now, and is that even possible?
Well, I think that the second part of your question is probably the more accurate one. I think it would be very difficult to do right now. I think that certainly Republicans in the Senate have been hostile to any sort of gun measures, and I think it would be difficult even in some parts of the House of Representatives. But we should not miss the point that the assault weapons ban worked, and I hope that that will be part of any eventual conversation.
One more thing on that. Critics say that the distinctions that make an assault weapon are arbitrary. You know, is it scope? Is it pistol grip? You know, specific characteristics, and therefore an overall ban doesn't make sense. Do you think that that's a fair criticism?
Well, I mean, I think that there's all sorts of nuance that you can add to these arguments. But in fact, the argument that prevailed from 94 to 204 seemed to be entirely workable.
All right. You are the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and you've been leading there in some other areas. I'd like to change our focus. Your committee sued the IRS and the Treasury Department over their refusal to turn over 6 years of President Trump's tax returns. Why is this worth litigating through the courts? And what do you say to those who say, listen, this tax returns thing, this is just politics. Cut it out.
Well, there's ample precedent for this, as we established 2 weeks ago. In 1969, the chairman of the Joint Tax Committee actually used Section 1603 to secure copies of President Nixon's tax forms. And the last eight presidents, including Richard Nixon, because there is a qualifying exception there, that Nixon subsequently did voluntarily release his forms, and all presidents since have released their forms to the public. What we're suggesting here is that we are interested in the policy side of this matter. We want to know how, in fact, presidential tax returns are audited. This seems to be a dark space. There's very little knowledge of it. We're told that it happens, and all we're suggesting through oversight responsibility is we'd like to know how it happens.
If President Obama had not released his tax returns, Representative, would you have taken the same steps?
Not only would I have, the Republicans were in control of Congress at the time. You could be sure they would have. I think the evidence is pretty clear on that. But I do think that when you suggest that every president has voluntarily submitted their tax forms for review, I think that's the better argument if this could have been done on a voluntary basis. And recall that at least three times during the presidential campaign and once as president that Donald Trump has suggested that he wanted to release his forms, but he was under audit, couldn't release the forms when, in fact, the IRS says that you could release them anyway. This is not about politics. This is about policy. I have very methodically, scrupulously, with great care, based upon the almost daily advice of House counsel, who, incidentally, has spent 40 years at the Justice Department and argued in front of the Supreme Court. They are the ones who had advised me on how to proceed. This is not about entertainment. This is more about informing the American people as to how policy plays out under this section of the law that is entirely clear. It says upon request, the IRS shall furnish those tax documents.
Representative Neal, you've emphasized this idea of voluntary participation. President Trump's administration is suing the state of California. They recently enacted a law that would require presidential primary candidates to release their returns in order to be on the California ballot. But the administration is saying, hey, a state can't preempt federal election requirements with their own. Should there be some level of federal legislation that compels candidates to release their taxes?
Well, there is federal legislation, and that's what is known as 1603. And it says that the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, the chairman of the Finance Committee, or the chairman of the Joint Tax Committee, they can request presidential tax forms.
But what about candidates? What about candidates for the presidency?
I don't know any candidates in my recent memory who haven't voluntarily released their tax forms. I think just about all of them.
Except President Trump.
Their tax forms.
So I think what I'm trying to get at is, should a candidate in the future be compelled, given that there was lack of cooperation in 2016?
Well, I think once this court case is finalized and a decision is made, I think likely legislation will flow from that judgment.
I want to ask in one other direction, Congressman. One of the questions that has split Democrats in the House and Senate is whether President Trump should be impeached. Do you feel the president should be impeached?
I think that Speaker Pelosi is handling this the correct way. She is saying that if you were to proceed with impeachment, that one of the difficulties you would have here is, recall that the House of Representatives, they essentially sit as the grand jury, and then the Senate sits as the actual jury. Speaker Pelosi, I think, has wisely said we should continue with our responsibilities of oversight and investigative authority to oversee the executive, in this case the president. But she's also pointed out wisely, I think, that you would need 20 Republicans in the U.S. Senate to vote for conviction. Not only do I not see us getting 20, I don't know where you go for the first one.
Well, that is a practical matter and understandable. The speaker has also said that President Trump has committed impeachable offenses. So has he committed impeachable offenses?
That's why she has encouraged myself, along with the other members of the key committees, the other five, to continue with our oversight responsibilities to secure the information that we need as we try to assemble that judgment.
So you don't have a judgment on that yet?
Well, I have a judgment on it. That is essentially similar to the one that she's suggesting. We should proceed with our responsibilities for oversight, see where it goes, and then make a determination.
So there's clearly at least some disagreement in the Democratic Party on this question of impeachment. Also on a number of other issues. Your primary opponent, Holyoke Mayor Alex Morse, he's just been endorsed by Justice Democrats, which is a national PAC that backed newly elected Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Well, I don't think they really did back Ayanna. They did the other ones, but I'm not sure that they backed Ayanna. You'd have to figure that out or qualify that.
Fair enough. Given their role in getting new congresspeople elected, you've been in Congress for 3 decades. You are the dean of the delegation. What's your response to those who say, listen, we've got fissures in this party and the face is changing and we have to have fresh leadership?
I think there's a judgment that comes based upon whether or not one is deemed to be effective in advocating on behalf of their constituents. And I hope that that's a record that we're going to have a chance to discuss during the course of the next many months. I'd put that record up there for scrutiny, and I hope that there can be a full-throttle discussion about it. But simultaneously, there's going to be a discussion on Alex Morse's record as mayor of Holyoke. Recall that the Holyoke Public Schools right now fell into receivership during his time as mayor, and during that period of time, he missed half the school committee meetings. That meant 28 out of 58 school committee meetings were missed. So I think that I understand how people want to discuss future campaigns and future candidates, but I'm happy to discuss the Secure Act, the IRS reform bill, the Butch Lewis Act, the Pride Act, and many of the things that I've done as I right now am in the midst of renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. I think that advocacy stands up under the scrutiny, under the magnifying glass of critical analysis, and I'm happy to debate it fully, as I intend to do.
Congressman, Justice Democrats say that they did help Ayanna Pressley with her campaign. Does that change your answer to my previous question at all?
No, not really. I mean, I think that that's up to them. I was told that they weren't in at the beginning, perhaps, but that's up to them. They can make that determination, and I'm happy to have a full discussion about it. I've had a pretty, I think, successful record in Congress. I've been returned many times by my constituents, and I intend to vigorously pursue another term.
Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, the dean of the New England delegation, we appreciate the full discussion you've had with us.
Thank you very much, and nice to be with you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we talk to two mayors whose cities have experienced mass shootings. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.